Culture of Adabit, episode 160, Following the Force, part 1, The Phantom Menace. Hello and welcome to episode 160 of Pop Culture Affidavit, the podcast that takes a look at everything random in the world of popular culture, which is brought to you by the Choo Choo Freaks Internet Radio Network. I'm your host, Tom Panarese, and this episode is the start of a series of episodes that is going to pop up on occasion and run for a while. It's called Following the Force, and what I'll be doing is working my way through a list of Star Wars media, starting with right before The Phantom Menace and finishing with The Rise of Skywalker. Along the way, I'll be reading books and comic books and watching television shows as well. The idea for this came to me a few years ago when I did a Star Trek-related reading project, which was working my way through all six of the original crew movies and their novelizations, but also jumped off from a couple of those movies to a few of the novels and television episodes that had had some ties to the films. For instance, I watched Space Seed before watching Wrath of Khan. It wasn't too extensive a project. In fact, I think there were probably maybe 10 books read altogether. It really wasn't very, very huge. But it was really fun, and it reminded me of how much I liked reading those books back when I was a teenager. I also realized that I could probably do this with Star Wars. I actually own a 3-in-1 book of the novelizations of the original trilogy. I've read a couple of the prequel novelizations, and since Heir to the Empire came out in 1991, I've read my fair share of Expanded Universe comics and books. So I figured, why not? I compiled a list of what I knew existed, and then I hit the internet for some sort of timeline that would include movies, television shows, and books, so it could kind of tell me the entirety of the 9 movie cycle and where everything fits among it. And I came up with a lot, and it's probably going to take me a few years to get through everything. So I decided that I wasn't going to worry about like how often these podcast episodes came out. They were just going to come out when I'm ready for to put one out. I put my list together starting with The Phantom Menace, despite the fact that chronologically the current High Republic series of books and comics and some of the legend stuff that takes place from a long time ago, like Tales of the Jedi, etc., they're more like the chronological starting point for all things Star Wars these days. The reason I'm not going all the way back there, it has nothing to do with my like or dislike for that iteration or anything. I've actually only read a couple of things, comics, that I actually enjoyed, but haven't really gotten into that yet. Plus, I wanted each episode to have like a movie or TV or something to anchor to it and really kind of like encompass like what I remember Star Wars being during a certain time period. So I felt like I wanted to begin with The Phantom Menace. So how does this work? Well, like I said, I made this list. It features Star Wars movies and television shows, and then I looked to fill the space between them and around them with books and comics. And once I got to one of those movie and TV checkpoints, I decided to do an episode, looking at what I covered. This obviously means 9 episodes for the 9 main Star Wars movies, but it's also going to include Rogue One, Solo, The Clone Wars, The Bad Batch, Rebels, a number of other shows like Andor, Obi-Wan, etc. So at least there's going to be at least 15, 20 episodes somewhere down the line. In each episode, I'll either begin or end with that anchor piece, such as The Phantom Menace, which is going to finish this episode. I'll review everything I read and watched along the way. Sometimes there'll be more to talk about than in other episodes, but I'm hoping to really get a new look at stories that I've been familiar with since I was a little kid. And I'm doing this because I think it's going to be fun. I threw together a list of things that are both considered Star Wars canon and are formerly canon, or the legends as they're labeled. I made the decision based on what looked good on the list that I researched, as well as what I already knew or what I already owned. So I'm really excited to tell you all about it. So where did I start? And how much did I read before I actually sat down and watched The Phantom Menace? Well, come back after the trailer, and I'll talk about the 3 novels I read before taking a look at what was once one of the most anticipated and much derided Star Wars movies.
You are about to witness history in the making.
Hi there, this is Todd from Forgotten Films, and if you spend all your time watching new releases, then you need to broaden your movie horizons. And a great way to do that is by joining me for the Forgotten Filmcast. We don't talk about the new releases, we don't even talk about the classics. We talk about the movies that time forgot. On each episode, I'm joined by another film blogger to discuss a film that may or may not be worth rediscovering. So look for the Forgotten Filmcast on iTunes, Podomatic, and wherever you find great podcasts.
I'm usually pretty good about letting you know my sources or of information or where I figured out what I wanted to read and watch and what order. For some reason, I forgot to write down where I got all of these books and comics and et cetera. It's kind of down the memory hole. But when it came to Phantom Menace, I was pretty sure that simply starting with that movie and working my way forward actually wasn't going to get me everything I needed, especially since one of the more important characters in The Phantom Menace is Qui-Gon Jinn. And he dies in the film's final act. So beyond that, at least on film, we never really got to know him. So this is exactly where the extended universe novels do come in handy. And like I said earlier, I'm pretty much going by an, quote, assembled canon. It's kind of a headcanon. I don't know what the term applies here. And I'm going to go spoiler light, I guess. The plot recaps for the books will be short. My reviews might be short as well because sometimes there's a lot to cover. When it comes to the films, I'll probably reveal everything because, you know, I mean, if you're listening to this, it's more than likely you've seen these movies. But if you haven't read the books, you can always pick them up and find out what happens, etc. Anyway, for this one, I chose three novels, one of which is in the official canon. The other two are now considered legends. The first of those is an official book. It takes place earlier than anything in my project, and that is, according to my various sources, 39 years before the Battle of Yavin. It's Master and Apprentice by Claudia Gray. The plot, briefly, is that Qui-Gon Jinn and Obi-Wan Kenobi are sent to another planet where Qui-Gon's former fellow Jedi is an administrator. Our two heroes are supposed to be protecting a princess who is about to be coronated as the planet's queen, and whose life has been threatened by an opposition force that has been performing terrorist attacks, as well as influence from a huge corporation. So I chose this because it's pre-Phantom Menace. I felt that it would give a little bit of characterization to Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon that we didn't necessarily get in the film. Unfortunately, this doesn't do much for me to really care about Qui-Gon, who is a character that I didn't love or hate in the first movie, but he's just kind of there. Claudia Gray, though, does a great job at characterizing Obi-Wan, who in this point in this novel is 17 years old. And he's kind of similar to Anakin in the way the prequels, like the later prequel movies in the Clone Wars would play him. And he means he's a little arrogant. He has some of the teenage impatience that his Padawan does later on. And there's definitely some impatience and brashness in him when you get to the Phantom Menace, but we have him a little bit closer to the start of the path of kind of like discipline. Plus, starting here and then going through two more novels before the film gives all of these stories a feel like they're the latest adventure for the characters. And I like the idea that we're coming in on something that's similar to being dropped into the middle of a TV season. The plot with Qui-Gon's former colleague, the princess, and the planetary chaos takes a little while to get going, but it does get intriguing when it's at its peak. And while Star Wars doesn't have like a Weyland Yutani, but this kind of comes close. It feels like this corporate entity is on the level of something like that when you read the Alien stuff. And it's kind of a cool idea. Like, I don't know how much it's been explored in Star Wars that corporations would have planetary influence beyond maybe, I don't know, Lando Calrissian and Bespin, but even that, it's Cloud City, and he's just kind of administrator. This is it is very close to Weyland Yutani. So it was an interesting take. Next up, I have Cloak of Deception by James Luceno, and he's taking on one of two EU novels that directly precede The Phantom Menace and literally set up a couple of the important elements of its plot. This one is under a Qui-Gon starring story, and it involves more political intrigue than it seems to involve the Sith or anyone else. Of course, at this point, the Sith really haven't revealed themselves to the Jedi. We'll get there. The story also involves a terrorist group, but in this case, it's not one that is a rebel faction on a distant planet. It's an assassination plot against Chancellor Valorum. Or is there? I mean, there's definitely an attempt on his life amid high tensions with the Trade Federation, but it's not entirely sure who's behind it. And as a result of the growing crisis concerning trade routes and the other complications leading up to the blockade of Naboo, he holds a trade summit. This brings together another assassination plot to light, and Qui-Gon's determined to solve the mystery and stop it before it succeeds. Of course, this is the machinations of Darth Sidious, who is directing the Trade Federation's members Nate Gunray and others who have ambitions and are building an army so they can take advantage of growing tensions and hostilities. As Senator Palpatine, he advises Chancellor Valorum and presses for the taxation of trade routes while remaining a steady presence in the Senate. Now, without spoiling too much, considering it's in The Phantom Menace, but this puts the pieces that open the movie in place. Valorum's rule is in question because of these tensions and a corruption scandal. It's actually suggested that he was should be investigated for profiting off the regulations he's putting in place. And Queen Amidala is elected to rule Naboo, which, going back to the previous novel, when I was reading that and saw the princess being young, be appointed queen, she is in the middle of the action at one point. I can see that Claudia Gray was trying to mirror or foreshadow the Phantom Menace so that when Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan get involved with the queen on Naboo, it's not the first time they've dealt with that sort of situation, but this time they're a little more experienced. So I can kind of give her a little more credit for that too, even if it's a little gimmicky, because you're watching this, you're like, oh, this is kind of like the movie. Here in Luceno's book, it's basically like a lot of setup. So she's elected to rule. Qui-Gon has these tensions with the Jedi Order, and they come to light, and Darth Sidious actually advises the Trade Federation to set up the blockade. And the thing is, I consider James Luceno one of the better expanded universe writers. He was one of the two writers, by the way, who worked under the pen name Jack McKinney. He wrote all those Robotech novels that I talked about years ago with Donovan Morgan Grant. Although back when I was reading those Robotech novels like 30 years ago, I had no idea who he was, because I only knew the name Jack McKinney. This novel, though, was uneven, and I felt a little lost in places. And I think it's because of the setup. Because, Claudia Gray did not have to set anything up aside from maybe the relationship between Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan, and she got to set it at a earlier place where one of them was way more inexperienced than he is when we see him in The Phantom Menace. The Sith were not involved in the original novel, not to the extent that they start to become here. Sidious isn't poking around. It is a lot of just foreshadowing the relationship and seeing who these two are. Here, Luceno actually has to put some pieces into place that will pay off in the film, and I think that might actually hinder him a little bit. Because this is the politics, right? It's the politics behind the prequels, Palpatine's machinations. So it's kind of a slow burn that doesn't have an enormous amount of set pieces. Funny enough, the climax, which is foiling assassinations at a summit, reminded me of Star Trek VI, which is one of my favorite Trek movies. The summit scenes are very well done, actually, but the problem is it takes too long to get there, and so the novel gets bogged down. So I have mixed feelings about it. One thing about the prequels is that the overarching conflict, this rise of the Sith and the origin of the Empire, has to start somewhere. And it's realistic to have small-sized incidents to be the things that add up to what eventually becomes a seismic shift. Remember, the American Revolution came out because of taxes levied by the king, and several incidents took place that eventually boiled over into the war. The Republic at this point hasn't had significant conflict for a long time. It means that they're complacent. They don't even have much of an army at this point, really. So while a huge catastrophic disaster would be dramatic, it's necessary for the player's movements to be subtle. Because you don't go to war without a buildup. Valorum's power being chipped away by Palpatine's machinations is well done. And we have a nice layer added to the episode one politics. But it's tough when you have to shoehorn in the Jedi, whose hunt for the terrorists or assassins doesn't exactly fit at some points. Or at least the pieces don't all fit together because they get distracting, especially because Lucenio continually comes back to the Jedi Order and almost overdoes it so that we know that they're there or something. Funny, though, it actually would have made a really good comic book. And the visuals, I think, you know, it's the jumping from storyline to storyline. It would help in that format because we are very used to the meanwhile-ness of a comic book. In the novel, it doesn't work as well as it could. But by the end, I was satisfied by the way it set up the movie and how it gives a little more characterization to the background characters in the setting, just as the next one does for one of the Phantom Menace's main villains. And that is Darth Maul, Shadow Hunter by Michael Reeves. This is another Legends book. It takes place around the same time of the Cloak of Deception. And that's immediately, like literally immediately before the start of the Phantom Menace. Instead of setting up the political intrigue of the movie, though, it's just a spotlight on Darth Maul, who was set up to be the coolest character in the new movie. And wound up having a Boba Fett-like life. And that he didn't have many lines, he died before the movie was over. And yeah, granted, I know that Boba Fett survives Empire, but he dies pretty early into Jedi. I know that Maul will eventually return in Clone Wars, but in 1999, we didn't know that. So there was always a bit of a letdown where he was concerned. I'll delve into that a little more when I get to the film. For the novel, it came out in 2001, so its release was between The Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones, so the idea that he was still alive somewhere or would come back was not in the public consciousness, maybe even Lucasfilm's consciousness at all. And it doesn't really give him a backstory. It's not like we get his origin, but it gives us a really, really cool look inside his head because he's serving Darth Sidious. And the premise is that as Sidious begins to put his plan in place to take power and bring down the Republic, one of the Nemoidians of the Trade Federation goes AWOL to Coruscant. And it's thought that, okay, he's going to reveal the plans to the Republic. You know, he's like, this is too much and this is not a good thing. I'm going to sabotage this. Sidious sends Darth Maul in pursuit with orders to assassinate. Things, as they do in a novel like this, get complicated. The Nemoidian is actually able to meet up with his contact, a man named Lord Pavan, and pass the info along. So Maul has to go after both of them. Then a Padawan named Darsha Asant, who is facing her last trials on the way to becoming a Jedi, winds up getting involved because she's just at the wrong place at the wrong time. She's supposed to like escort a prisoner who is part of a terrorist cell that has nothing to do with the Sith, and it's implied that the Jedi had just kind of taken care of them. So there's this other thing that had been going on, and this becomes this distraction that's inserted. And what happens with the novel, it's a prolonged chase scene. Darsha discovers the Maul. And basically what happens is she tries her best to make sure that the Jedi get the information about who he is to the Jedi. And they're fighting in like the depths of the planet. So if you know anything about Coruscant, it's just city and it's levels and levels and levels and levels, kind of like jets and stuff, right? You know, the higher level, the richer you are. So, but they're nowhere near the surface of the planet. So you kind of get the darker underbelly of it. And the narration is from the third person point of view, but we shift between points of view of different characters. The most interesting, of course, is Darth Maul. What we get is interesting because it's the mind of a subservient cult member. It's also one who has a deep hatred for the Jedi. He is different from Vader in that Vader's characterization is someone who is ambitious and as well, but was also conflicted, at least when you factor in the events of the prequels. So with Maul, it's just a methodic pursuit of his prey, which sometimes proves challenging, but we see his determination and resourcefulness. The character of Darsha, who does not survive the book, I'm sorry, is well written, and you actually care about her, and you want her to succeed or at least survive, but everyone around her seems doomed in one way or another. I guess knowing how things play out after this novel and that during The Phantom Menace, the Jedi Council are now just learning that the Sith have returned. You can't fault Reeves and the novel for having a lot of the heroes essentially fail. Because like I said, it's really character building for Darth Maul. It really makes him cooler. It really makes him more vicious. And this sort of zealot that I think is really interesting because it's so much different in many ways than what we always get of Vader. And really, really cool way to write a popular character from the first prequel film. We also get in this novel, it's actually a look ahead to the next movie in the series, is, like I said, Coruscant. I remember when it first appeared in the Timothy Zahn trilogy, Heir to the Empire. In fact, I believe Zahn ended up naming the planet. I don't know if that was official on the part of Lucas or that he named it and Lucas adapted it. I read this somewhere. I can't remember off the top of my head. Either way, we see it in The Phantom Menace, but we see it at its height. We see it near the sun. We see it in the beauty. But in the clones, we get a little bit more of a spotlight and we get a little bit lower, if you remember some of the things. And then we'll talk about that when I get to Attack of the Clones. And what we have here is a taste of that underside of Coruscant. The pursuit begins in the very, very dark ground levels, which I was picturing more Blade Runner than Star Wars when I was reading it, but I think that's probably the point. And it's actually pretty cool. You know, one of the things that Star Wars excelled at was giving us glimpses into the seedy underbelly of the galaxy. Most of the time we saw it on planets like Tatooine, like Mos Eisley and things, and then Jabba the Hutt, etc. But looking at the underworld on the most important planet of the galaxy is really cool, and I might have to seek out a few other stories that go down this road. By the way, much like the previous novel, this novel also ends right where the prequels pick up. In this case, the threat to his plans is eliminated, so Sidious tells the Trade Federation to begin the blockade of Naboo. And that's literally the point where The Phantom Menace begins. Now, before I begin getting into the plot and my review of The Phantom Menace, as well as the novelization, the comic book adaptation, I have to talk about the lead up and the experience of watching it in 1999. And I guess part of this will overlap with things I said or wrote about on episodes of this show, maybe even my appearance on my Star Wars story, but I'm pretty sure that both of those episodes were at least a good 10 years ago, even blog post. It was a very, very, very long time since I talked about this movie or Star Wars in general in the sort of blog podcast sphere. So maybe the statute of limitations for repeating myself has therefore lapsed. I mean, who cares really? I'm just doing this as a complete to me Star Wars project, and it's going to include my memories of what I've read or watched in the past when it comes to all of these films and TV shows. So the story of The Phantom Menace, or at least its origin and how I remember it, begins around October of 93. I've been a huge Star Wars fan as a kid. The time I was out of elementary school, I hadn't really watched any of the movies for at least a few years, and I had only really picked up anything Star Wars related in 91 when Heir to the Empire came out. I was in eighth grade by then. In the fall of 1993, I was starting my junior year of high school. The Last Command, that's the last of the Zahn trilogy, original Zahn trilogy, had come out that previous April. I'd read it as soon as it did. In fact, I had all three of those books in hardcover. So the new Expanded Universe sequel books had me primed for anything to come. By the way, the Zahn trilogy, Dark Empire, they're not on this reading list because of the way they go completely off continuity thanks to the way Disney rebooted things post-Jedi. I may do a separate side quest or interlude episode where I read that trilogy and the original Dark Horse series just to take a look at the books and comics because they were so formative and to see, like, what are other interpretations of the aftermath of Return of the Jedi. So stick around for that at some point. But anyway, back to October of 93. So October 6th of 1993, to be exact, it was a Wednesday. I was watching the tail end of the evening news on our CBS affiliate. I think it was that anyway, because I'm pretty sure that Hard Copy or Entertainment Tonight came on right after it. Either way, I'd just been trying to avoid the cesspit that was the Full House Family Matters rerun block. and the news was on. So there was this brief news item that I remember used some footage from the original trilogy as well as a few behind-the-scenes shots from those movies. There was an Entertainment Tonight interview with Leonard Maltin that, according to YouTube, is from 92, but Variety officially confirms the prequels are coming into production in October of 93, so I'm going to kind of go with there. Now, it's nebulous, and my accuracy doesn't really count. It's just that in the early 90s, Lucas announced that there were going to be three more movies. And I remember being curious, of course, I guess. I may have given it some thought, but at that point, there was nothing but a news announcement. I couldn't really get hyped. The internet was not what it is now for people to hear an announcement and all of a sudden go off the rails with predictions and then pissing and moaning as they do. And the Zahn trilogy ended, so I actually was starting to taper off reading Star Wars books. And honestly, beyond comics, I don't think I really did a lot of reading that wasn't for school around this time. So I just kind of filed this away. I mean, maybe I figured I'd believe it when I saw it, right? So the special edition came out in 97, and there were more murmurs as to what was going to be into this prequel trilogy, and I have to admit, I wasn't exactly following it very closely. At that point, I was a sophomore in college, and I got bits and pieces of entertainment news. But really, when I think about it, I was annoyingly out of touch with a lot of stuff back when I was in college. It's kind of like this weird bubble that I was in. So I got some entertainment news where I was able to watch like MTV or VH1 or read issues of Entertainment Weekly. But I didn't feel as plugged in as I would for a while in my 20s to a lot of these things that were going on. But I did get some hints as to who was being cast in what role during the next couple of years, and eventually started to really read into it as more news came out. And I did buy the battle droid riding a STAP, I guess I'm going to say STAP vehicle from Kenner, because Kenner put that out as the episode one preview toy. And that was in 98. Also in 98, there were the first looks of actual pictures and footage from the movie. There's that poster that Jake Lloyd is a young Anakin casting the shadow of Darth Vader. And then there was the very first trailer.
Not condone a course of action that will lead us to war.
A communications disruption can mean only one thing: invasion.
At last we will reveal ourselves to the Jedi. At last we will have revenge.
Begin landing your troops.
We haven't much time.
The Federation has gone too far.
The death toll is catastrophic.
Our people are dying, Senator. We must do something quickly.
You must contact me.
There is something else behind all this, Your Highness. They will kill you if you stay. And I can only protect you. I can't fight a war for you.
I think we're going to have to accept Federation control for the time being.
This is a battle I do not think that we can win.
I will sign no treaty, Senator.
You said people are gonna die?
Once those droids take control of the surface, they will take control of you.
I was not elected to watch my people suffer and die while you discuss this invasion in a committee.
Never get me onto one of those dreadful starships.
Always two. There are a master and an apprentice.
Wipe them out. All of them.
No!
Now, I know that one of the first reveals of this trailer is on Entertainment Tonight. You can see that footage on YouTube. I remember that my college roommates and I saw it on the evening news. I'm pretty sure it was WBAL 11 in Baltimore that showed it toward the end of their broadcast because we taped the segment and we just watched it over and over and over again. And then we heard about people going to the movies to pay full price for a film. And I think in our area, I remember it being the Will Smith, Gene Hackman movie, Enemy of the State. It might have been other movies as well, but they were going to it just to see the trailer and leaving the theater before the movie began. Crazy. I mean, most people who are listening to this are around my age or older. You remember this. It's kind of funny that I don't know if like the youth know about this. And I think I wonder what their reaction would be because like it was 25 years ago and the way we get trailers has changed so much. Like we literally get commercials that say go online to watch the trailer, which are just like, why are you doing this to me? And trailers themselves have changed so much too. So I'd be curious as to see like what they would think of if I told them, hey, like when Phantom Menace came out, before it came out, people were literally going to the movies just to see the trailer because you couldn't get the trailer online. And they'd probably be like, all right, old man. But yeah, the movie was hyped. Posters, commercials, a clip-heavy music video for John Williams' Duel of the Fates track from the score that made its way onto TRL.
We came all the way from Michigan to New York City with a group of college students. And instead of going to the bar last night, we went to Toys R Us to get some Star Wars toys.
Are you kidding me?
No.
You are such a geek, Stacey.
Yeah, I am a geek.
That's awesome. I'm so proud of you because I'm a geek too. That is great. What you got?
We got new lightsabers.
Stacey's working the crowd. Did you get the groovy double-edged?
Double-edged sword.
Those are badass.
They're awesome.
I'm going to have to stock up on those. So you're ready to check a third look at the Star Wars video. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah.
Are you guys ready?
Yeah!
Very well. Let's take another look. The London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by John Williams. This is Duel of the Fates.
The following is your first shocking glimpse into the latest top-secret project from one of the world's most notorious stars.
At last, we will reveal ourselves to the Jedi. At last, we will have revenge.
I watched that as well. I was not a TRL person. I'd come across it every once in a while on MTV, but you know, this was 99. So this was like right before the movie came out. And that was the height of boy band Britney, like teen pop of the 90s. And I hated teen pop and I hated most of the pop music and rock music of the late 90s. Anyway, but that was pretty big, you know, getting like that much exposure to a orchestral track, and you've got all this footage and stuff. And there were also, to get into what else was going on with the Star Wars promotion, tie-ins, right? I remember seeing over and over and over again a commercial that was like a combined effort on the part of KFC, Taco Bell, and Pizza Hut, where you had like the Colonel Sanders, the Chihuahua from Taco Bell, and just a girl in a Pizza Hut uniform, and it was like they were Star Wars posing or something at the end of the commercial because there was like a big tie-in.
Somewhere in the universe, the ultimate evil stirs. But three legendary heroes have come together and will lead the battle to save the galaxy from the menace of the dark side.
Right after lunch.
Play Defeat the Dark Side. Collect cool Star Wars game medallions and you could win cash prizes, even $1 million. Only at Taco Bell, KFC, and Pizza Hut.
Now, I actually don't have a lot of merchandise from Phantom Menace. I was a fairly broke college student back in the late 1990s, and whatever money I was spending went toward either comic books or beer. I did have the preview toy. I bought a Darth Maul figure. I had two Darth Maul figures, I think. I bought Amanda an Obi-Wan figure because she had a thing for Ewan McGregor. At one point, it probably as gifts, I wound up with Anakin's pod racer and a Naboo starfighter toy. And for me, it was more about seeing the movie anyway. I mean, I after I left toys behind as a kid, I never really got back into them as collectibles. It was just, I have nothing against doing that. It's pretty cool to see people's toy collections, but it was just not a road I went down as far as collecting things. So anyway, it was about the movie. And I was wrapping up college when it was coming out. In fact, I was graduating on May 15th, and that was the Sunday before it premiered. But I didn't get a chance to buy tickets pre-release because I was just so busy with college shit. And I didn't get a chance to see it on Long Island when it dropped because about a day or two after graduation, I actually had to fly down to Northern Virginia to go through security clearance for my job that was starting up in October. So this was in Tyson's Corner for the better part of a week. And I remember walking around the mall because I was trying to kill time before I had to drive back over to National Airport, and was in a bookstore, and I saw a lot of the promo stuff, stand-ups of Jar Jar and books and novelizations and things like that and whatever in a couple of stores. So I do remember seeing its presence in the mall. When I would see it just a few days after it came out, though, it was in Charlottesville, actually, the Carmike Theater. It's now a trampoline park. I was there for Amanda's graduation from UVA. She graduated a week after me, and we went with her parents to see it. Then I went again after I got back from Charlottesville to the Patchogue UA Theater. It was one of my two hometown movie theaters, and saw that. And then I go see it up in Boston with my friend Harris when I went to visit him at the beginning of June. That weekend was cool because I saw the trailer. We went and saw Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me as well. And it was the first time that I saw the trailer for The Blair Witch Project. I had no idea that The Blair Witch Project existed at that moment. And the trailer, the original trailer for The Blair Witch Project is just really, really enigmatic. And like, you're like, and you had no idea what this thing was. You're like, what is this? And I started scouring the internet and found a lot of the promo material. And I did a whole Blair Witch episode a few years ago with Mike Bailey that talked about that. And to this day, when I talk to people, we talk about this movie. I talk to students, actually, and I tell them like about the marketing and how like really cool it was. I find myself getting excited because I have really, really cool memories of that movie. But anyway, I saw The Phantom Menace three times in the theater. To this day, it might be the most I've ever seen one movie in the theater. I mean, I saw Jedi three times, if you count the special edition, because I saw it in 83. I saw it in a re-release in 85, and I saw it in 97. I saw Forrest Gump three times on three different dates with three different girls back in 1994. I saw American Pie three times. Amanda, my friend Catherine and I went to see it, and then Amanda and I saw it again at the Arlington Draft House that fall. I don't think I've ever seen a movie four times in the theater. Anyway, I was really excited for this movie, and I don't think I felt let down by it. I mean, I even bought the special deluxe edition of the VHS. It had like a cell from it or something, and it had like all sorts of extras. I sold it on eBay years ago for like very little money, and I watched that a couple of times. And what's interesting is I don't have it on Blu-ray or 4K. I just have the DVD, and it would actually take me several years to buy the DVD. I don't know why my opinion changed or why I was so hesitant to get it when DVD came out. Maybe I was just interested in other stuff at that point. At some point, though, I did see the cracks in the movie, and well, did become a bit of a prequel hater, maybe a prequel snarker. I mean, I fell into the dunk of the prequels camp like I think so many of us did. And in retrospect, it's a shame because I have great memories of the summer of 1999, and a number of them were because of Star Wars. But yeah, it was a letdown on some level. And when you think of it, could The Phantom Menace have really been anything other than a letdown? Like, could it ever fully lived up to its expectations? Because it had a couple of things against it right out of the gate. And first was that pressure to perform. I mean, we are talking Star Wars. And we are talking Star Wars back when only the original trilogy existed as far as films were concerned. And the original trilogy was iconic. It was culturally significant and changing. And you had to meet or top that. How are you going to do that? That's an enormous amount of pressure. It's a very high bar to clear. And I remember seeing a headline on the cover of Entertainment Weekly, and I think it was either late 88, 98, or early 99. I think it was around like the year end or year preview issue or the summer preview issue or something. And it was speculating on whether or not The Phantom Menace was going to be able to beat Titanic's box office record. Now, Titanic had just left theaters like maybe a year prior, because I think by Christmas of 98 it was out on VHS. So the idea that Star Wars was going up against Titanic as far as box office was concerned would have been on everybody's mind. It was a fairly recent thing, and Titanic was enormous, right? And that typified the 90s. So much of the 90s was about box office. I mean, I guess the 80s was too. I was too young to really take that the way that we have horse race box office stuff these days. But the 90s, I remember it was about like what's making money and who's the biggest gross thing. And a lot of that was like really, really on the forefront of my mind, but probably just because I found out about it and followed it a lot more. But anyway, like I said, the bar was set really, really high. So that's the first piece that was had it against it. But the second thing was The Matrix. And I have to say that the commercials for The Matrix look cool in the spring of 99, but Keanu going, whoa, was dumb. And it sounded very Keanu. Because let's be honest, Keanu wasn't a joke entirely, but on some level kind of was. You know, didn't have the gravitas that he has now with the John Wick movies and things like that and his roles as Neo. Like Matrix was like a huge career revival for him. And by that point, you know, he had done a few movies, but it, you know, his last great movie was probably Speed, and that was about 5 years prior. And plus, I'd been through all of those mediocre 90s computer VR movies. The Lawnmower Man, which, yes, is actually kind of a fun movie to watch because it's kind of a schlocky, like, dumb horror movie. But there was, like, Ghost in the Machine, Virtuosity, Johnny Mnemonic, which starred Keanu. So that's kind of what was on my mind when I saw the Matrix trailer. So I didn't actually really have much faith in the Matrix. And I've proven completely wrong when I saw the Matrix in the theater. And The Matrix made a huge impact when it premiered. In fact, its innovative filmmaking and cool style made The Phantom Menace look stiff and stodgy by comparison. It had more of an immediate influence on film, too, and culture than that Star Wars prequel. Plus, there was a backlash to The Phantom Menace, like I said earlier. And even though I joined the dunk crew, I will say that there was a little too much vitriol toward the movie. And it did fall prey to being that sort of being an asshole about something makes you look smart pretense of the 90s. In short, it became cool to hate it. And like I said, I shit all over it as well. I mean, granted, there were diminishing returns on repeat viewings of the film. And it had a number of flaws. Pacing, dialogue, Jar Jar Binks. But it's been 25 years. And I honestly wanted to know, can this movie redeem itself? Well, I'm going to do the good, the bad, and the ugly of the movie. And for the sake of time and not insulting your intelligence, I'm not going to give you a plot synopsis because I'm pretty sure you know what happens in The Phantom Menace. So let's start with the good. Honestly, watching it a couple weeks ago, and this is the first time I think I'd watched it since maybe 2014 or 2015, I saw the plot making a lot more logical sense than all of the tired jokes about how it was all about political procedure and taxation. The main plot going in is that Palpatine, who is also Darth Sidious, and Lucas doesn't pretend that the audience is unaware of that, by the way. He's making his power play. Chancellor Valorum, who is scandal-ridden, as we saw at the end of Cloak of Deception, is basically impotent. Especially when it comes to this blockade that's going on. Lucas has Palpatine play chess, and part of that is having small conflicts that eventually lead to important changes, like by raising tensions against possible enemies. The blockade of Naboo is something like the Berlin blockade of 1948, because even though that didn't lead to an outbreak of war, it helped reaffirm the United States and contributed to the importance of NATO. It was a power play on the part of the Soviet Union. It didn't go the way they planned, and it wound up giving the United States and the Allies a boost of cachet. Palpatine's gambit isn't for the Republic to look good, at least on the surface it is, though. On the contrary, he's exploiting the ineffectiveness of the Senate and helping the Trade Federation become more of a threat than is previously considered. By having them blockade his own planet, he's working up sympathy and support toward what will eventually be his election to the chancellorship. He knows that he can work all of this in both the shadows and in the open, because either the Senate is either up its own ass and full of hubris, and they're probably so used to political plays like this one that he makes that they don't even suspect anything about him being behind the blockade. Plus, the existence of Darth Sidious is completely unknown. Even toward the end of the movie, all the Jedi wind up knowing is that there is Darth Maul, who by the end of the film is dead, and they actually are openly wondering who the second Sith is. For his part, Anakin Skywalker is coincidental. Incidental? He needs to be there for the sake of the overarching story of the prequel trilogy. But discovering Anakin on Tatooine winds up being more or less a side quest that none of the main characters were expecting to undertake. To me, though, it works. You need the rise of Darth Vader to coincide with the fall of Anakin Skywalker. And if you don't have the initial rise of Anakin Skywalker as a good character, how are you going to be invested into his fall into darkness? Another item in the good column is an obvious one, is Darth Maul, and it's the lightsaber battles. There's a very brief one that he has with Qui-Gon on Tatooine that works really well, but that showcase one at the end, it's one of the best ones in all nine of the films. Lucas does this great job of intertwining the three fronts of fighting in and around and on Naboo. And every time he cuts back to the lightsaber fight, it's really satisfying. I probably don't need to tell you that, though. But the action is also great. Yeah, it goes with the lightsaber fights, but the battle scenes were really good. It felt like Star Wars, but also feeling a little bit different. One of the things about this prequel trilogy is that we're seeing the Old Republic and fighting during a time where I guess it was more formal in a sense than what you would see in the middle trilogy. That is, of course, because they're a band of rebels and riding out to the battlefield like William Wallace isn't going to be the best tactic for them. The armies clashing on Naboo felt very Roman Empire, kind of even American Civil War to me. It made total sense for a world or galaxy where the, well, ancient by then, structures of the society and the traditions that came with them were still in place. And when the action becomes all-encompassing in the film's third act, Lucas does a great job of editing all those pieces together. I also thought the production design was great. It wasn't The Matrix, no. The Phantom Menace was never going to be The Matrix because it's not what would fit The Phantom Menace or any Star Wars. And it's an imperial age, no pun intended, a look at the days right before the fall of the empire, the Roman or the British Empire, whichever one you want to pick. This is hubris. It's ostentation. I love the Baroque feeling of Naboo and its palace. I love the overwhelming metropolis of Coruscant that is part Blade Runner and part Fritz Lang. Although I've gotten tired of Tatooine over the last several iterations of Star Wars, seeing more of it here was actually pretty cool, especially the cities on the planet and how the huts run things. And rounding out the good stuff is the performances. And yes, you heard me, because Ewan McGregor is a great Obi-Wan Kenobi. Liam Neeson plays the wise mentor role very well. Ian McDiarmid's return and expansion of Palpatine is incredibly well done because he's smarmy without being too obvious as a senator. And he's chilling without being too con when he's Darth Sidious. Nothing against Montalban, but it takes a couple of movies for Ian McDiarmid to really eat the scenery in that way, right? But like I said, if you already know he was both people, you wouldn't get the hint that his Senate moves were anything more than just politics. And hey, I'm also going to defend Jake Lloyd. The 90s and early 2000s have too many kids on TV and movies who are precocious, and they act or are written more significantly smarter than their ages. With 10-year-old Anakin, I think Lucas is trying to give us Henry Thomas as Elliot in E.T., not Macaulay Culkin in Home Alone. They don't exactly stick the landing when it comes to the writing portrayal of the character, but it's still a solid job, especially when it's one of a lot of expectations for an actor as young as Jake Lloyd. The yippee is silly. I know that his commentary during the space battle gets made fun of, but he's a kid who's never been off his home planet, and he gets to fly a spaceship. He's genuinely excited, even if he is pretty scared at the time. And who of us didn't try to do our own running commentary or dialogue whenever we were playing pretend when we were kids? I appreciate Lloyd's giving kids a character to identify with and giving them some sadness as well. Anakin's too young to be truly hardened at this point. He can be a little bit, he still needs a fair amount of innocence for us to be sympathetic and really kind of get into the character. So that by the time we hit the end of the movie and then into the sequels and then into episode two, we are, we're kind of with him and we feel that he's a good person. But now the bad. And I'm going to start with the performances. There are times where Jake Lloyd could have toned it down. Funny enough, you ever think of what the Phantom Menace would be like if Dylan or Cole Sprouse had played Anakin Skywalker? Because they end up playing the kid and Big Daddy about a year later. Of course, you know, they go on to other things. But, I mean, again, Lloyd's good. It just kind of, that just kind of popped into my head. Anyway, the performances. He could have toned it down. Liam Neeson really didn't give me much to care about when it came to Qui-Gon Jinn, I have to be honest. And I get that Natalie Portman and Keira Knightley, because Keira Knightley's in the Queen's costume for quite a bit of the movie, give so many flat deliveries. And I kind of confirmed this when I was on IMDb, because I like to look at the trivia, and I read that the actresses were code-switching when they were playing Amidala, that when Amidala is in her official capacity, they were trying to put on official air. But when Natalie Portman is, quote, Padme, there's that screen has come down and she's more familiar and she's actually better. Now, knowing that, I'm like, okay, that's a really good idea. It doesn't always work, but also remember, Amidala's like 13 years old, so the idea that you have to put on an act to look official because you are so young also makes sense, but still, don't stick the landing entirely. What also doesn't work is the pacing. The Naboo sequence in the beginning of the movie, especially that underwater sequence, is really slow. The pod racing sequence takes too long. Yes, it reminds me of the Ben-Hur chariot race, but like could have been trimmed down just a little bit tighter. And when the action gets going in the third act, everything does come together, but there were pieces that were kind of a slog. And I think I actually got up to get a drink or something when they were on because they just weren't holding my attention. Maybe that's a me problem though. But then there's the score. Now, not the score itself, but the fact that the film's score runs so much throughout. I love the score to this movie, but there could have been a few moments where we just had the actors talk or the action happen without a musical background. But this is my old man yelling at a cloud moment because I've been screaming about how movies are overscored for years at this point. So take that what you will. And finally, I have one item when it comes to the ugly of the Phantom Menace. And I know it's been 25 years, but even after 25 years, I still hate Jar Jar Binks. I'm sorry. I just cannot with the character. The Phantom Menace as a film didn't deserve all the ridicule it got back in the early 2000s. It is not the best of these movies. It's not the best of the prequels. In fact, I put it around like 7th or 8th on my list of the 9 episodes of the Star Wars saga. Right now, it's toward the bottom with The Rise of Skywalker. But it is a solid watch, and the end of the movie made me excited to see what was going to be coming up next. Now, of course, is Attack of the Clones, but I have a little more on my list here, and that is adaptations or novelizations. I read the novelization, and I read the Dark Horse Comics adaptation and Marvel's 25th anniversary special that for The Phantom Menace that came out earlier this year. The novelization was by Terry Brooks. I don't know if I've ever read anything he ever wrote. Most of my novelization experience has been via Star Trek, which for me is the gold standard. But I'd actually read this years ago, and I had told myself I was going to read all the novelizations back then, and I stopped after Attack of the Clones. So this is kind of, this project's kind of a reboot of that. But anyway, I remember liking it. I was eager to pick it up again, mainly because I remember it giving me more of an appreciation for the movie after I'd read it, so I was looking forward to it. Now, I read the novel this time around the day before I watched the movie, so I think that was my only real mistake here, because it made the film redundant. Next time, I may watch Attack of the Clones before I read the comics, or I may put some distance between the comics and the novelization and the film. I think it was rushing because I actually had the time to watch it, which I don't have a lot of time to watch movies during the day. But the novel itself starts out great. Instead of having the Jedi on the Trade Federation ship, we actually begin with Anakin on Tatooine, and we look into his thoughts as well as his life as a slave. There's also some of his passion for pod racing and pod racing highlights that precede the big race in the middle of the movie. It would not have worked in the film because it would have been too slow, kind of like how the Luke on Tatooine scenes at the beginning of Star Wars would not have made sense or slowed the opening of Star Wars down in that movie. But anyway, what Brooks does is it shows you the advantage of the written word over film because you get an omniscient narrator, and Anakin is probably the best part of the novelization because Brooks writes him as a good kid who was a nice boy. I mean, Lucas does too, and Jake Lloyd tried to act it that way, but this novel gives him another layer of innocence that's really necessary. There's no darkness behind the eyes or any suggestion that he's ever going to be Darth Vader, except for the way that Palpatine's kind of creepily watching him, or at least he says he's watching him, and it comes off as a little creepy, but it's supposed to be ominous, so there you go. The initial relationship between Anakin and Padme was well done. It was a reminder that she's actually pretty young. It's only a 3-year difference between the two of them, if you think about it. Now, the difference between 13 and 10 is huge. So, him having a little crush on her, yeah, we all had little kids have crushes on older kids sometimes too, because they're discovering who they are. So it's not too weird, but you can't get too far with it without it becoming weird. Now, when they're in their 20s, it's not as weird. And I also think that when you consider that he and Padme grow up in different environments, and they're rebelling or want to get out of them in some way, Padme, for instance, pretends to be her double and goes into the city with Qui-Gon, you can see how the two of them connect. There's a kindred spirit in there that I don't think either of them knew existed. Now, I don't know what this will do for me when episode 2 rolls around, because that has some of the most notoriously bad dialogue in the entire Star Wars saga. I guess we'll see. When things get going in the plot, though, the novel is by the numbers. And that's fine, because Brooks does his best to highlight the movie's strengths. Although, man, having to read Jar Jar Binks' dialogue phonetically is a chore. All of the Gungan dialogue is written phonetically. It is a chore to read. Now, as far as the comics go, the adaptation was published by Dark Horse. You know, Disney bought Marvel and Lucasfilm at one point, so Dark Horse lost the license, and all of the Dark Horse stuff ported over to Disney, and it actually is available on the Marvel Unlimited app. So it's cool because I didn't have to seek it out. And it's going to sound dismissive, but it's the movie on a comic page. It does what it's supposed to do. I didn't feel like there was anything added to extra to the story if anything had been interpreted one way or another. It didn't give me the kind of fun, joy, and interest that the Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back adaptations from Marvel give me from back in the 70s and 80s. I mean, we'll get there eventually, but it does its job. It's solid. It's not terrible. And I realize I did that quickly. I'm sorry. I mean, I'm almost an hour into the episode anyway, and I'm trying to keep the solo episodes not too long, because who the hell wants to hear me talk for this long? But I wanted to get to the original comic featuring these characters, and that's the 25th anniversary special that Marvel published earlier this year. It has an outstanding cover by Phil Noto, then again, when is a Phil Noto cover not outstanding? And the creative team is Greg Pak with Will Sliney as the artist. There are several stories or scenes in this book that take place in between the story beats of The Phantom Menace. First, we have Anakin with a prophetic dream where he looks like Hayden Christensen and he's rescuing his mother from Tusken Raiders. Then he rescues the Tusken from some shady businessmen and enslavers before going back to work for Watto. It's right before the Jedi show up and the pod race. Then after the pod race, he and Qui-Gon have an extended conversation about his potential as a Jedi, although we see the Council turn him down. The rejection of the Jedi Council causes some tension between Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon because of the way Qui-Gon seems to stand up for Anakin while ignoring his current Padawan. Obi-Wan even mentions that Anakin seems dangerous in some way. Now, having overheard that, and despite Jar Jar's insistence that Anakin has a good heart, he asks Qui-Gon if he is dangerous, and Qui-Gon replies that Anakin is special and needs training. We then flip to the Battle of Naboo's aftermath. This is where Anakin and Obi-Wan talk about Qui-Gon's death, and there's tension between the two of them because of the way Obi-Wan pegged him as dangerous in an earlier scene. But Obi-Wan has said that he promised Qui-Gon that he would train Annie, and he does believe in him. It's one of the things running through Anakin's clouded mind at the funeral, the Council not agreeing with him, his mother, and the dream he had about being older. It's all swirling and confusing, but Obi-Wan's belief seems to give him confidence and a little more clarity. We end up back on Tatooine with Shmi Skywalker at home. A Tusken comes to the door. He offers a black melon as a gesture of kindness and tells her about how her son helped save him. And as Tusken leaves, she says that she had a dream that Anakin had become a Jedi. And like I said, this is a between-the-scenes look at Anakin in Episode 1, and actually I really enjoyed it. Sometimes these tie-in one-shot specials are nice, but they don't give you a lot, or they're just kind of flimsy. This isn't. This really does work itself in well and give you some good characterization while keeping things where they should be. I like how it built a little on what Terry Brooks did in the novelization, but it also has the advantage of the remainder of the trilogy to pull from, so we get those visions of them, of the Hayden Christensen Anakin Skywalker. And this also establishes the inherent goodness of the character some more before he becomes corrupted, and it makes his fall even sadder. So that will conclude the first episode of this Star Wars-related series. Remember, this is an occasional series. It's going to come out whenever I get to my next thing. And this next cycle will begin with the James Luceno novel Darth Plagueis and end with Episode 2, Attack of the Clones. Then I plan to spend a couple of episodes in the Clone Wars with the Bad Batch as well before ending the prequel trilogy. I say that I'm off to a good start here, and I'm excited to see what's coming up because everything, at least from what I remember, gets better as we head further into the prequel era. If you're interested or you have any questions or comments or want to relate like what you remember about The Phantom Menace and some of the EU stuff that came out around the time, drop me an email. I am on Instagram these days. Pop Culture Affidavit, and then I'm on Blue Sky as well. I was Tom Paneris, actually, I'm using my real name as the Blue Sky account. So you won't see me posting too much to Twitter, even though that particular application is open. Spotify-wise, it seems like the feed that is associated with the actual Two True Freaks feed is working properly. So there's because like I said, an episode or two ago, there's Pop Culture Affidavit and there's Pop Culture Affidavit Two Freaks. Just look up Pop Culture Affidavit. I'm probably going to take down that other feed at some point in the next few weeks so that this main one remains. It seems that things have worked themselves out. Now, older episodes may not all post. Spotify keeps flagging a bunch of them because of music used. And from here on forward, I'm really not using a lot of copyrighted stuff. Now, there's some stuff in here that's trailers and clips. Probably would win on an appeal. I don't know. But for now, older episodes you will be able to find on the TTF website as well as the Apple feed. Spotify is just, twitchy about these things. But at any rate, Episode 2 will be somewhere down the line, and I will let you guys know when it is. I'll be back next month with another episode, maybe something that ties into the holidays. We'll have to see how I'm feeling, because it's been a little bit of a rough last few weeks. But anyway, as always, thank you very much for listening, and take care. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Affidavit, which is produced by me, Tom Panneries. All clips are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. This podcast is a part of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you can find at twotruefreaks.com. If you like the show, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps the show get noticed by other people. Feedback via email can be sent to popcultureaffidavit@gmail.com. For show notes and essays and other things random in the world of popular culture, visit popcultureaffidavit.com. You can also follow this show on Facebook at facebook.com/popcultureaffidavit and on Twitter at popaff. That's P-O-P-A-F-F. Thanks for listening, and come back next time for more pop culture randomness.